everybody. This is Armand Demel.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
With you with the positive mind. That theme song. It's quite a theme song. It's called Dreams of Children.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
By Shadow Facts, for those of you who want to know, and was given to us as a gift to use. I'd love to hear it played by a few different instruments, you know, if anybody wants to take the theme song.
What a great idea.
And reproduce it. I have one celloist who's working on it now. I'd like to hear it. I'd like to hear it in different instruments.
It's a pretty...
haunting.
Harmony, yes.
Talking about things that people like, Roberta. Talking about things that people like. Here it is. Pizza. Yes, yes, it's time to talk about pizza. It's time to talk about pizza because pizza is going to teach us a lot about life. Because, I mean, pizza is everywhere.
Pizza has been around since the Etruscan times, and it's all over the world now.
Now, not all over the world just as, you know, tomato sauce on bread. Pizza shops, pizzeria. How do you say a place that sells pizza?
Pizzeria.
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 Right.
Not the way most people pronounce it.
How do people pronounce it?
Pizzeria. Pizzeria. As if it's in the back of the place. The rear of the pizza. Pizzeria, so anyway, the whole idea about why there are pizza parlors everywhere, all over the world, is really a key to what we're going to teach you today. Pizza is the kind of food that you go to at certain times. Now, there are times when you have no time, and you're out of energy, and you have no time, and you just can't afford to do it. You rush out, grab a slice, right? That's one time. There are other times when... when you're down and you're in a bad mood, you just want a slice of pizza. There's great pizza, and there's good pizza. And then there's that thing that they sell in the refrigerators called packaged pizza. You've seen those, especially the...
I have seen it, yes, Armand, I have. Even in health food stores.
Yeah, the organic
gluten-free pizza, wheat-free.
And cheese-free.
Cheese-free, right.
Wheat-free, bread-free.
Yep, it's all free.
It's all free. And you.
But it's very expensive, actually.
Yes, and you eat those, and of course, if you're on that kind of a diet, they actually taste pretty good because they have this hint in it. But the real pizza is by no comparison. No comparison to that, right?
Right.
Where's the greatest pizza you ever had, do you know?
Definitely in Italy.
Really?
Sure.
Really, really.
They have a way of making it that it's really unlike anything you can find here, except now there are some Italian people who have come over and have established gourmet pizza restaurants, and the pizza they make is... identical to the one they make in Italy, and what a difference.
One of the things you're going to wonder, why are we talking about pizza? Well, you know, this is about the beginning of mankind. This is about the origin of a species. This is about a lot. We're going to get to that with you. Stick with us, friends. Pizza. You know the difference between great pizza and not so great pizza that I discovered when I was a kid? I used to watch the man make the pizza, and of course, the more he kind of handled the dough, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when he put it down, the secret that they no longer use is he used to put olive oil on top of the pizza dough and then put the sauce on. And then, but you know, they took out the olive oil. In all the pizza parlors, you don't see the olive oil anymore.
That's true.
So the olive oil was underneath the sauce, and that olive oil in the dough is what renders that fantastic flavor.
Sure.
That you see so rarely nowadays. But besides that, you know, some people think pizza is a lot of poison because it's got salt and sugar and other stuff like that. What would be a food that a strict vegetarian would eat?
Well, generally when vegetarians have a craving, they will go for sweets. And that's because vegetarians usually crave protein. And whenever you find someone who is low in protein, you will have a person who craves sweets. So I'm not sure that there's an equivalent in, and I'm assuming you're talking about vegan people, meaning totally strict vegetarians. I don't know that there's an equivalent to pizza. It would be more like going for the vegetarian cookies, the vegetarian cakes, the vegetarian desserts.
So there's a secret in here about why cravings or the treat, and I don't think pizza is just a treat, because, you know, if you look at people with pizza, it's always been amazing to me to pass by the Ray's Pizza, which is always a big place, you know, and they have these tables, mm-hmm. and a man orders his pizza his way, you know, with either this topping or that topping, and he gets his pizza and he sits down. And almost everybody who eats pizza alone does not want a conversation with everyone else. It is not a conversational thing. You don't go to a pizza parlor to meet somebody, because people want to eat their pizza alone. In fact, I have watched most people eat their pizza with their arm wrapped around it, like the prisoners would be wrapped around their food in a prison. It's like they're guarding their pizza. And when there's a special look on their face when they take a bite, but it is not a social place. Because of what pizza is and what it represents, just as what protein bars mm-hmm. represent and what the other thing. Now, let's take this one step further. So we're saying that pizza represents something that's going to teach us something. Let's talk about food in general. I remember your, and it's not a promotion of it, Roberta, but I know people who have eaten your nut milk. Right, drank your nut milk, right, mm-hmm. the nut milk you make. And the one thing about the nut milk you make is that it takes a tremendous amount of to create it, right?
A tremendous amount of energy.
Energy.
Yes, it does. It's handmade, and it requires really a very firm determination, let me call it, to extract that milk from those nuts. They won't let go of it easily.
So you got to squeeze. You got to squeeze the nuts with your hands, and I could see your grasp must be very...
Very strong at this point, yeah, because you really do have to use your strength to get the milk out. There's no other way. Or, I mean, you can settle for the nut milk that comes in a carton that is... Well, I'm not going to say what I think of that, but that's nothing like what we're talking about. When you want to get that milk out of those walnuts and pecans and Brazil nuts, you have to use your hands. There's no other way.
Well, that's funny, because pizza is a handmade food.
Right.
And so is that nut milk, because I know people who are completely addicted to the nut milk. You know, I mean,
I have heard that. That yeah. is addictive.
Okay, so...
In a good way.
So... Then what's the difference between, let's take a look at one of Mama's best foods. Or let me ask you in the audience, what is your favorite food? Think of a favorite food that you have and think about these variations.
You know, the one I'm thinking of is definitely made all by hand, definitely.
That special one.
Yes, the one that has a funny name. It's called canederli, and it's a food from the northern... Italian Alps from the mountains, and it's yeah, growing up that was my favorite food.
Made by hand, now you give away a secret of what we're talking about here, because there, now the beginning, pizza is handled. There are two ways to make a pizza. You could make a pizza by having it go through a machine, processed machine, and then you flip it into a box and you freeze it and you send it off. That's one pizza. But you ever notice that when you eat those pizzas, you feel one way. But when you get the pizza from the pizza parlor where the guy has handled it with his hands...
Well, when he even throws it up in the air and does like that whole... goes through that routine where the dough is really not just handled, but handled with a lot of energy and played with and made, I guess you could say the person is putting their energy into that food.
So handled by hand seems to make a difference. By hand, you know?
Right.
So think about your favorite foods. Your favorite foods. If you had to make a choice out of your favorite food, let's say you like spinach, would you like it if it was home cooked? Would you like it if it were cooked by a restaurant? Would you like it if it was a fast food? You know, if you went into a fast McDonald's sells now spinach, and you could get fast food spinach. I don't know if they do. If you could get frozen food spinach, canned food spinach, right? Or dried spinach, which you add water to and it reconstitutes like something they have out in space. Which of those do you think would be the one that would satisfy you the most? Obviously, it's the one that you create with your hands. So there is something about hand-touched food that makes the difference. The difference between restaurants and homemade food is not so different because, you know, the restaurants are close, or they used to be, but now the restaurants are all wearing gloves. See? And the restaurant food has turned different. And you'll find that there's a different feeling about, let's go out to the restaurant. Because even though I know we're being safe about the germs and everything else, there used to be something about the fact that somebody would make you food by hand. They called it home cooking. I don't know how you could call it home cooking if you're wearing latex gloves that come out of a package that have some kind of a coating on them.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Now you make a good point, Armand.
You know, I remember I was once with my dentist, and my dentist was trying to find out whether my tooth was right or not. And I said, and she was feeling it with her finger, you know, through a glove. And I said to her, well, take off your glove and you'll be able to tell if it's sharp or not. She said, take off my glove. I haven't taken off my glove in years.
It's unthinkable, yes.
It's unthinkable to touch your tooth mm-hmm. with a finger, right?
Yes,
and
yes,
I have
yes.
to actually use that. So back to food, hand-touched food, when you make your own food. Now think about a pre-washed spinach or spinach that you wash yourself. Do you understand? You are putting yourself, your hands, into that food. What is it about hand food or food that is handled that seems to be so different? I mean, it really seems different.
It does.
I mean, dumplings. You know, I was watching a show on dumplings, Roberta, and I was watching how they make dumplings where they roll them in their hands.
Well, that's what canadelli are, by the way.
They are dumplings.
They're a kind of dumpling, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, and I mean, if you serve salad where the food is going to be eaten raw, I guess it pays to be safe and to expect the person who is preparing it to wear gloves, because these days, you know, it's better to be careful. But if the food is going to go in the oven or in the pot and is going to be boiled, baked, heated up to a point where no bacteria or other critters could survive, well, then why wear gloves?
Just wash your hands.
Yeah, it's true that the food that's handled by a person tastes different. And this is something that actually, Armand, when I went to the Institute of Macrobiotics, which is, you know, this form of vegetarianism that comes from Japan, and it's based on a philosophy that I guess, I mean, it's not just dietary, it's also a philosophical approach. But anyway, the leader of this movement, Mr. Michio Kushi, he, one of the main things that he taught was exactly this, that we really, his idea was that people can heal through food. And he was saying, no matter how organic or vegetarian or excellent quality food you eat, unless it's handled by people with good intentions, that food will not be good for you.
Ah, good intention. Now there's a thing, because this is leading us to where we're going, my friends. Good intention in the handling of your food. Therefore, if you prepare your own food, right? If you prepare your own food, if you cook it yourself, if you handle it yourself, if you make it yourself, it's got to have a wonderful harmony, don't you think?
Oh, well, it depends what kind of mood you're in. Armand, I guess if I'm in a good mood and I like myself and I intend to nurture myself, sure. If I'm in a bad mood, maybe I would rather buy food that someone else has prepared, someone in a good mood.
Not a bad idea. So if you think about it, mood and intention are kind of related when it comes to food. See, food, mood, intention, and pizza. Pizza, the guy who makes the pizza, he's happy making a pizza. He's got an intention to make a pizza. And if he's not happy making the pizza, if he's somebody who's just doing it for a living, which very few people do, I mean, most people who make pizza like doing it, right? But if he's just doing it perfunctorily, you get that feeling. I mean,
perfunctorily.
Yeah.
What a nice word.
Why do they leave out the olive oil? You know, what do they do?
Because
they,
everybody's afraid of fat.
Now, with
I
pizza,
think so.
You can't be
I
afraid
think
of,
so. I
you
know, think
I don't
so.
Think so. I think you just cut down on the money.
Because then they can say it's low-fat pizza.
But I don't think anybody sells low-fat pizza.
Oh, there must be. There well, must be. Anyway, I think that might be one of the reasons. Also, it might be, you know, that it's more expensive. But
you know why? Because olive oil is another thing that's squeezed.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I mean, these represent very important things. The dough is kneaded, it's touched, it's squeezed. Olive oil, although it may be squeezed by a press, you got to pick those olives. You
oh,
know
and if
I mean?
You want to go all the way back, Armand, you in Italy, when you see the olives, they are always grown together with vines.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of work that goes into joining these two plants and making them grow and develop together in a certain way. So you really, I mean, you're talking about a long line of people involved in the process of making this food. By the time it gets to in front of us and we're about to eat it, if we think about all the people who have contributed to it, it's an amazing number of people.
And the thing about the olives that I think was important, again, is that there's so much handling of an olive. You know, you got to do it by hand. You don't really pick olives by machine. You know,
right.
For most olive oils, you've got to get that down there. So just to complete this thought, because we're going to bring you to our primary thought here, the intention of food, which is what Roberta is saying, you know, the more, the further away you get from the intention of your food, the positive intention, and here's what we believe. We believe that you energize food when you touch it with hands. Now, how is that possible? How is it possible you energize food? That doesn't make sense, but it does make sense. Let me go back to Bernie Grad. Bernie Grad was a man who I used to lecture with a great deal. He worked for Wilhelm Reich. Wilhelm Reich was a scientist. He used to study energy. He was a wacky guy, but he studied energy and energy fields, and he was studying energy, and he went into a hospital, and he had this experiment. They took a number of seedlings, and these seedlings were wheat seedlings, and they were all identical, all from the same field, and they watered them, but they watered them with three different groups of people. They had one group of people who were known to have a green thumb just by reputation. And they had, that's one group. A second group was what was called a normal group of people, the average person. And the third group came from a hospital. And in this hospital, there were these very depressed people. Oh, and there was a fourth group in the hospital, manic and schizophrenic, hyper-energy people, okay? So they had everybody, they took a big bowl of water, put it in a paper bag, and they told everybody, please hold this bottle of water that's in a bag. No secrets, please hold it for an hour. And everybody held it for an hour, they got paid for doing this, held it for an hour, and then they would take that water and they would water the seedlings. What do you think happened? Absolutely true. People with the green thumb, for whatever reason, their plants grew bigger, stronger, and better than anybody else's. So this thing about, you know, can you grow plants, and you say, oh, plants always die around me. There are people who can grow plants, not by skill, it's something about the energy, and people who don't. The water of the people with the green thumb, those plants grew strong and firm. The average person had an average growth. The depressed people's plants withered and died, and the manic people, schizophrenic people's, plants grew tall and stalky and fell over. They grew faster than they should. This at McGill University with Wilhelm Reich. Now, this is kind of a fascinating thing. What were they doing? They were holding a bottle of water. It was going through the paper bag, through the water, and they were holding it in two hands. How does that energize anything? Well, we believe that things get energized. And so if things get energized, and this is what makes plants grow, and the energy is what makes the pizza so appealing to people, I'm making that. That'd be an interesting thing. I wonder if depressed people eat as much pizza as people who are not depressed. What are we looking for in food? We're looking for energy. Energy. Energy, the intention of energy. It's what's in the hands, what makes the hands count. And I'm going to go further to say not only that, but later I'm going to make a case for sex has nothing to do with sex itself, but mostly has to do with energy. And when people buy sex, they're buying energy. And I think that there's a lot of difference between anything you buy that is truly energetically instilled and that's not. Big difference. Big difference. French fries. You know French fries, Roberta, they no longer cut French fries in any restaurant. French fries have been so effectively packaged that they are now prepackaged in every restaurant in the world. Nobody cuts their own. I mean, it's silly. Even in the fanciest, fanciest restaurants, they pull out a frozen package of French fries that are cut.
What a shame.
And those, when they're cooked, may taste somewhat delicious, but it's a whole, the old French fry is gone.
Of course.
Except the one you make at home.
Right, right. Yeah, well, Armando, absolutely. There is a taste in food that's prepared by hand that I think almost anyone could recognize, given that they are aware of the question. You know, because normally when we eat, we don't really think, well, has this been made by someone with a good energy or a bad energy. But if we thought about it, I bet that we could tell, and I bet that we would notice when food is rich in energy that goes beyond the nutrients that are contained in it, and it has a quality of energy that energizes us on some other level, other than the physical level. I think it's something that's really beginning to dawn on people, that there is something to this.
Maybe,
idea,
you know,
which
maybe
of course, I mean, the person who came up with the idea of homeopathy, he figured this out, Hahnemann, I think his name was, he figured it out a long time ago, and there's a whole school of medicine based on just energy. So it's a well-known fact.
You know the difference, Roberta? If I have dumplings that are prepared by a Chinese restaurant that are sent to me, they don't have that feeling. They don't have it. If I have pierogi made by somebody at home, that's one feeling. But, you know, I just imagine what it's like to be the person who makes dumplings in a Chinese restaurant, right? How much intention can you have? You're turning out 1,000 at a time, and you're turning them out, and you're going to sell them not there at the store. You're sending them out to some people who are rich, who have more money than, you know, your entire family has. So you're the dumpling maker. How much, as a dumpling maker, how joyous can you be? So there you are. There's a hand food that comes to you. But by the time it gets to you, it's filled with,
Mm-hmm. That's true in this country, in this society, Armand, but I think in a country where people may be, may have less wealth, someone with a job making dumplings may be very happy.
Very happy making that, right.
Right, and so then those dumplings would have a different energy than the dumplings that you are talking about.
And the energy is a positive energy, and we want it now.
As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about the fact that in America, we now know, because we have read it everywhere, there's an epidemic of diet-related pathology, and I won't get into what the different illnesses are, but also, people seem to really have a confused relationship with food. They don't know what to eat. They don't know when to eat. They don't know how to eat. They don't know what's good for them, what's not good for them. I propose that in part this baffled relationship may be the result of food that has been mass-produced by machines for a long time. And this is really the first time in history that a group of people as large as this has been fed by machines for extended enough period of time that we could measure the quantitative results. Do you know what I mean, Armand?
I do. And, you know, even though things we're talking about food, we're not talking about food. We're talking about the very reason for the war in Iraq.
But food is a way in which people can understand what we're talking about, I think, more easily than if we talk about other examples.
Exactly, because we are talking about
clothing,
energy.
One could talk about
we're
books,
talking about energy.
Wait, anything.
We can go everywhere. We're talking about energy, and we're going to describe to you some of what we realized is about the energetic exchange. What happens, and if it's not exciting, if it doesn't bring an energy to you, you may not want it. But we are willing to bet, and the reason I mentioned the war in Iraq, what is the war in Iraq about? It is about being the masters of energy. What is all this issue about oil? You know, what? Because it's about energy. So when we get back from our break, the very first thing we're going to do is we're going to talk to you about the very meaning of energy on this planet, the very existence of energy, the very birth of energy, the very how it began and how it's taken us and how it manifests in almost everything we do, and how the absence of it in the foodstuffs that we take in is very significant, how you can get depressed from food, how you can get excited from food. And it's the same thing with love, and the same thing with sex, and the same thing with music. So we're going to take a short break, Michael, and when we come back, a little bit of energetic music, and then Roberta will be showing us the origin of energy. We'll be right back. And that's what they offered. The Beatles came on the scene in the early 60s, or no, late 60s, and they came into a depressed society. And, of course, Elvis Presley came in first, and Elvis Presley was kind of whipping it up. But remember, these are all born out of blues, and blues were born out of, you know, depression. So depression leads to blues, and then suddenly somebody stands up, and he starts wiggling, and he says, oh, rock and roll. And this turns energy around, and the world notices, and they say, hey, music is not supposed to be that energetic. Don't shake your bodies. Don't be that energetic. It's the work of the devil. And so then the Beatles come along with absolutely no restrictions, and they put all the energy out there that everybody was waiting for, and that thing happened to us. We were infused with them. Why do you think we went to Beatles concerts and begged and screamed and yelled? Why? Because it was the most energy that ever existed anywhere up until that moment. It was like a New Year's Eve party every minute. If you put the record on, everybody got up and danced. Energy. Energy. What is this? What is it so important? So you buy a record and the record says here's a record of energy. And you buy it and you put it on and you feel it. What, Roberta, what is energy about?
Well, there was a time when the earth was didn't have life on it. It was a planet like the others with rocks and, you know, different structures, but nothing that we would consider alive, according to the definition of the word as we use it today. So what happened was that there were, the plants, there was life for a while that didn't utilize the sun's energy, and then this was the plants. They figured out the chlorophyll is a molecule in vegetation that is like a little miniature baseball glove, and it catches the photons, the light particles that make up the sun's rays. The chlorophyll, shaped like a glove, in the leaf of the plant, catches the sun rays and stores that heat in the form of energy inside itself, inside the plant, for later use. So that was, I think, the first brilliant idea that led eventually to pizza.
Sure, and well, actually before that, Roberta, they were the single cells. They were the paramecium. They were the single cells in the water
right. That
turned their up to the sun, and they said, "Ooh."
Well, no, they couldn't do much with the sun because they didn't have a way to catch the light.
So it was the cells that found a way to organize into a plant that created a way to catch the light. Now, when we talk about light, what are we talking about?
Photons.
And that is the energy of life. You see, without it, there is, I mean, there is some argument to this, which we could talk about later, but without the sun, there is no life. And I'd hate to tell you how important it is. Because people now see the sun as an enemy. You know, they see the sun as a thing that's going to kill us. It's going to wipe us out. Now we have no ozone layer. It's going to burn us and give us cancer. Why do you think people go to the beach and want to hang out at a beach and walk around a beach and feel the sun rays on them? Because it is the most natural thing in the world to be like a plant, to turn your leaves up to the sun and absorb the sun's energy. Absorbing the sun's energy. Am I trying to make a case for sun tanning? No, but I'm trying to say to you, there is a thing here that is, humans are like plants and nothing more. We are energy suckers. We need to replenish the energy just like a plant does.
But in fact, when we eat, we're eating sun's energy, because all of the food we eat, including the animals, if a person is not vegetarian, are really the result of this chlorophyllian function that was developed by plants billions of years ago. That was the start of this whole thing that eventually led to pizza. And what Armand is saying is that we are alive because the chemicals that make up the structure of the planet figured out how to assemble in such a way that they're able to capture and utilize the sun's energy with the utmost efficiency. They're able to store it and retrieve it. And everything we do from the moment we wake up to the time we go to bed and even while sleeping has to do with energy consumption, energy absorption, and energy utilization, and energy expenditure. All of it. The whole thing.
And reproduction, absolutely.
That's what it's all about.
You know, I used to remember, when I used to work with, I used to do some conferences with Gary, you know, Gary Null, and Gary would say there's dead food and there's live food. And the difference between the dead food and the live food is the live food was the food that was most recently filled and preserved with the true energy. You see, whereas the dead food would be that's been dried and been packaged and boxed and shipped.
And some people figured out a way to measure that energy in the food. And if you take food that has been deadened by the processing, let's say, and hold it with the intention of re-energizing it, actually, Armand, according to the instruments that measure that energy, you can do so. You can, even food that has been killed and is no longer nurturing on the level of energy, you can put your own energy in it if you hold it with that intention. And you can measure the shift of that food with instruments that are designed to do so. You can energize anything you touch if you have that intention. So it's true that we can...
And you do, whether you do energize it, whether you have the intention or not, Roberta, because
yes.
You could be...
Yes, of course.
You could be a prana sucker, you know? You could be somebody who is so low on your energy that you're going to suck energy from everything you see.
But in fact, what's the whole idea of healing, Armand? Isn't healing someone who has temporarily a lower than average level of energy goes to someone who, by definition, a healer, has energy to spare? Someone who can spare some energy. You know, I mean, in the end, that's what...
It's an energy exchange.
It's an energy exchange.
Sometimes,
yes.
And there's one other condition, which is when your energy has run rampant, when your energy is haywire. Sometimes, I mean, what our ideal condition is, we have energy and we have it ready to fire. That's our ideal. It's like we have a good storage of energy and we're ready to move with it. We could dance with it. We could do what we want with it. It's fully accessible. There is times, however, and many of you know people like that, they've got their energy, but the energy is not organized, so the energy is haywire. And those people go to healers and take drugs and drink and do chemicals because they're trying to organize their own energetic system. Hyper anything. The word hyper means too much energy. You know, excited means energy. Hyper excited means too much energy. So you could have it in one of the two directions. You could either be hyper or you could be hypo energetic, or you could be somewhere in the middle, which is where most people are. But now, you bring to me, Roberta, when you say a person is looking for energy, they go to their source of energy. And by going to a source of energy, who are you attracted to? There's a lot of movie stars, and you could tell there are movie stars that are attractive, you know, that have energy to spare. You know, there are singers, there were performers. Those performances are so fantastic because they give you bolts of energy. You know, if you go to Madison Square Garden and you watch somebody put on a performance, it's not just the singing. They do fireworks and pictures and things, so they shoot them out at the audience and you get charged.
I guess that's why with people like rock stars, they get all the privileges, you know, of the best this and the best that, and they get so much energy from the crowds that adore them that then they're able to take that energy and metabolize it and then throw it back at the crowds that you know, I think if you're as a performer or as a public speaker, as anyone who deals with large groups of people, if you're able to get in that relationship where you get a lot of people to give you a lot of energy for whatever you do,
you set up a loop.
Yeah, you know, you set up a loop.
I in many times where I've given lectures, or just even last night where I was doing a wedding ceremony, there was a loop that set up with the audience. And I know you, Roberta, when you do your workshops at the different places that you do them, you sense the audience and you sense their response. And if you move a little away from their responsiveness, where the loop gets closed because they get curious and they don't know what you're talking about, you kind of change a little bit, to open up the loop. Do you know what I'm talking
sure,
about?
Sure.
So if you start talking about something that's too complicated and they furrow their brow, you know for the moment they're closed off.
Yeah, I think that's how anyone who performs, really, you need to feel attuned. You need to be attuned to the energy exchange that goes on between you and the crowd or the group of people that you are performing for, no matter what your art or what your skill is, because it does become an energy loop. And there is something very nurturing in being at a concert where you're feeling energized by the music or whatever event that might be. But I was also saying that then these people get energized by the adoration or the privileges that come with being someone who is willing to sustain this level of activity. It does require the willingness, I guess, Armand, to risk a little bit more than average, because what if it doesn't work out? What if in the exchange you get devoured, you know, and energetically speaking? And there are people who burn out from trying this loop, putting themselves out there as someone who can give all this energy to the crowds, but then the crowd just eats you alive, in
well,
a sense.
Well, because not only the crowd eats you alive, but they don't know how to make
right.
the loop happen.
That's what
Let
I was...
Let me give you an example of this.
That's what I meant. If you don't know how to set up the loop, you could end up losing a lot of yourself in it.
Because you keep pushing it out. And I don't think it's the audience that's eating you up. I think it's you that's eating yourself up by putting energy out where it doesn't get reciprocated. It's like love. It's like loving somebody who doesn't love you back. You know, I mean, how long can you go on doing that before you're going to get depleted by it?
Right.
So, this is Armand Miller and Roberta Maria Atti. We're talking about the origin of the earth, which we're talking about energy and the very factor of energy, the very fact that we are energy machines, every one of us, and that no matter who you are, your primary reason to be alive is to gather energy. Your primary way of staying alive. You're an energy gatherer. You're gathering energy right now from our voices. You're taking it. That's why you don't have people who meditate doing radio programs. Do you know what I mean? I mean, great men. Imagine, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to lay back. All right, now, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to center yourself and close your eyes. And that's why. That's why they don't have us. That's why meditators and people like that. That's why people as great as Stephen Hawking cannot do great workshops. I mean, Stephen Hawking would have somebody who could translate everything. But there is something about the lack of energetic exchange that the audience can't tolerate, and it doesn't work.
Hmm.
You know, it just doesn't work.
Well, that doesn't apply to me, because whatever I
you,
yeah
sure.
whatever I can get of him, I would just, I couldn't get enough of him in terms of what he has to teach. But I was thinking, Armand, as I was listening to you, that eventually what ends up happening for a lot of people is that when the loop is set up in such a way that it doesn't bring back as much energy as what we put out, many of us, that's when we look for spiritual nourishment, and that's when we turn to the, you know, spiritual development or spiritual gurus or spiritual books or spiritual whatever. Because I think eventually we get to a point where we reach for energy in these higher realms. And you are absolutely right. Eventually it comes from oneself, because it is from within the self that we reach for that higher level of being. I mean, the spiritual experience is within us. It's not out there.
But I think you're saying something very important, Roberta, that I never thought of before. All of the things that humans do can be thought of in terms of an energy search. Everything, I'll bet. Everything, any human, anybody listening now, you're going to have a little coffee? Energy. right? You're going to have a little tea energy. You're going to have whatever you have energy. But what you just said is very important. We are going to look for energy wherever we could find it. When we can find it on the planet, it is perfectly natural to think, well, where does energy come from? And some inside part of us says, well, it comes from the sun. And then some other part of you said, you know, people said the sun and God are kind of related. So then you say, oh, God and the universe, and now you're looking in the universe. But remember, the sun is the source that we're looking for, you know. And then we say, oh, it must be in spirituality. But spirituality represents the sun.
Yes, in the esoteric tradition, the sun is not a physical being. It's an energy being. Sure.
So what we're looking for is we're looking for the energy of the sun. And when somebody says to you, I will sell it to you in the form of higher consciousness, we buy it because we think of higher consciousness as an electronic source of energy. We believe if we reach it, we will feel a sense of bliss by being unified. Now, this is the great addiction of the depressed. People who are depressed are always looking for energy.
Mm-hmm.
They must find it, because of course you would. If you were a plant who was sagging because it's been raining outside, you know, you reach out, you grow little, you know, or if you're a plant that's being covered by a tree, you send out little shoots so that you could reach up and grab the sunlight again.
And eventually, Armand, I think that, you know, there are some people who are so serious about reaching up and out, I mean out and up, I mean, I don't know, but reaching high for this energy that's, let's say, divine, that they stop eating. There are people who are really in tune with God or whomever is out there that did all this. They're able to feed directly off the source. And they no longer need to feed off of the more down-to-earth kinds of energy. So they're able to do away with horizontal energy search because their search goes totally vertical and they're able to connect with that source. And it seems to me that historically, if you look at what spiritual seekers do, that's kind of the path, that they stop looking at the material and they look more and more into the subtler and subtler until they reach to this infinite source of energy.
And it may be all illusory because they may just be looking for the source, which is the sun. You know, you speak about it, so he's a perfect, he comes a perfect circle form. So all the way to reaching to the source, which is going to be our benign sun, right? Source, like pizza source. Okay, Ra, the sun god. Remember Ra? The Egyptians used to worship Ra. And Ra, the idea of Ra was he was the direct one. He was the god of the sun.
But what I wanted to say was that eventually when that is found, it is found in oneself, that there is this source of endless energy that we keep looking for it somewhere. It's got to be somewhere. Where is it? Where is it? So we try this, that, and the other. But eventually, through spiritual awareness, I think, eventually we find it somehow within our own life, therefore within ourselves. I think there is a sun inside every one of us.
Well, you know, in a way, I think you're right. But I don't think that the spiritual awareness necessarily facilitates anything. But I think what we have inside of us is we have a collecting cell, like photosynthesis. We were talking about the chlorophyll. We have a collecting cell that would walk through life, Roberta, and normally I would collect energy from you, from everyone around me, and I would facilitate that and somehow give it back. If I'm in my healthy loop, I am a loop of energy. I take energy and I give it out. I take energy, I give it out. That's the way the digestion tract is designed. You eat food and then you put it out of your body and it becomes another part of Earth's energy. You know what I mean? What we think, I don't think what eventually happens is we produce our own sun. No, I don't believe that. I believe we take away the blocks that is stopping our machine from becoming the energy reciprocator, effective energy reciprocator. So what psychotherapy does, it'll take away the depression that's getting in the way of me being able to be the real chlorophyllic receptor, the one that's going to be able to look at the love in your eyes and take it in and give back the love that I feel back, that kind of feeling. I have to do something to clean myself out. And if it means I've got to do a spiritual search, a therapy search, or a nutrition search, if I got to cleanse my body, or if I have to go get colonics or whatever I have to do to get myself to feel like I am now an efficient source, that's, I think, the ultimate goal, that my machine is working to get and to give back the energy. And to me, that's what an ultimate relationship is like, a love relationship.
Well said, Armand. Well said. I think we are like the fish in the water that says, where is the water? I think we are surrounded by energy. And it's in the being able to take it in and give it out. It's not so much that there's a lack of energy. It's that we, as you just said, we may not be able to take it in, or we may not be able to give it out.
That's right. The block could be anywhere.
Both ways, whether we are not able to take it in or give it out, that's going to interrupt that loop. And when we interrupt that loop, whether it's in the outgoing or in the incoming, we're not going to be able to get nurtured enough to feel good. And
feel
that's
alive.
Alive. And that's when we think that, you know, that's when we start looking for this, that, and the other. And I think eventually we find a path, all of us, which you just described, a path that might, you know, work for you. I think eventually we all find the path that works for us, where it just simply means we're able to activate that loop.
Hopefully, you know, Roberta. And of course, if you don't find the path and you give up finding the path,
maybe then, that's the path.
Well, the next path is let yourself die and move on to the next path.
Right.
You know what I mean? In other words, there are people I know who give up searching. They give up. They're waiting to die. And energetically, according to, you know, just the rules of nature, that makes sense because nature has death as part of the source of energy. It says, okay, you over there who cannot reach for me, you die and become food for the others. You become a source of energy for the others. So as tragic as it seems, the design includes the opportunity for many to create the right side kind of reciprocity that allows them to give and get energy. And I think that's what a relationship is. I think that's what love is.
I agree.
A love relationship is being able to hook up with somebody and eventually have children where this energetic exchange takes place. If one person in that energetic exchange is broken, then the energetic exchange dies and everybody suffers by it. Everybody feels the depression and loss of it. Right. And that's where we rush off to find some help, which is very available to us.
Right. Yes. So why did we talk about energy today, Armand? I guess because it's a good thing to be aware of how our loop is functioning, right? And if our loop is a little rusty, nothing like a little olive oil on your pizza or on your
loop.
Gluten-free, wheat-free, cheese-free, everything-free, whatever it is that you eat, to reopen the loop.
Gotcha, Roberta. Pizza. Hey, listen, my friends, thank you for being with us. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. If you want a copy of today's program, you can call my office at 212-757-4488. Roberta?
CreativeHealthSolutions.org.
And I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Do go to thepositivemind.com. And check out what's available in our archives.